The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
I'm Matthew Patrick Shaw with the Office of Career and Professional Development, and today we're going to talk about secrets to successful callback interviews. And I'm pleased to be joined by WCL alumnus Dan Binstock, 2000, all the way back to when. Dan will tell you a little more about his background. But we are going to, I mean, certainly a lot to talk about, points to present, et cetera, but it's probably going to be most helpful to hear from you folks in terms of what you're experiencing out there, in terms of preparation you feel you need, answers to questions that you need addressed. So, as I said, we have plenty of content, we have plenty of handouts, and we certainly will have lots to say, but we definitely want this to be generated from your experiences, your questions, your concerns, and take it from that point. Just by show of hands, how many of you have had at least the screening interview at this point? Okay. How many of you have planned at least one callback interview? How many of you have been on at least one callback?
Okay. Yeah, so there's a diversity
at that way over there. Any offers?
A couple of offers.
So there's lots of questions that even arise from those dynamics in terms of go on callbacks, if I have offers, if I haven't had any callbacks yet, what are the processes to take from that point forward? And we'll address all that stuff. But
do you want to start asking to list some key questions from the audience at that point, Dan?
Sure.
Let's throw out some of the issues that you're facing. We'll put them up on the board here, and then we'll integrate the answers in our comments. But yeah.
Any others? I mean, we can certainly
Sure, I'll just give you a little bit of quick background to who I am and the perspective that I'm bringing to everybody today. I'm, as Matt said, I'm a 2000 graduate from WCL. When I graduated, I went to practice IP law from Finnegan Henderson, which is a large IP firm in D.C. And in early 2004, I left the practice of law and became a legal search consultant. And basically what I do is all of my clients are the firms that you're interviewing with, well, most of them, during fall recruiting. And I help them find attorneys, lateral attorneys, for their practices. So I deal with these firms on a regular daily basis, know what types of attorneys do well on interviews, know what types of attorneys don't do well, and have a lot of insights and sort of secrets to share with you guys. So I think it's great that you're coming out today, because you're going to get a definite leg up over all the competition by knowing a lot of the insider information. And Matthew also has great information as well. And between the two of us, I think you're going to walk away with a lot of insights that you just really won't be able to get on your own, and save you from having to look back when it's too late. So I think it's great that you all came out with it.
We have some handouts that we'll start passing around, and we'll talk from them as well a little bit, but don't get too involved with them now, obviously, you can read them. Some of these handouts, actually, some of them are currently available on eCampus Recruiter, the document library, and the others will be made available today. And one is the OCPD callback tips and sheet. The other one is what preparing for you to go interview like a lawyer, and the other is sort of Q&A questions and answers that Anne solicited of his clients about what their expectations are going forward during the interview process, and some of their tips on, hey, hey guys, how to lower this, I'm not together. So it's coming to you from a couple of different formats, but it's all good, it's all now, it's all current, it's all your screen, it's the next half hour. So,
thank you.
That's right. How many are there, though? Yeah, there are how many? Yeah, four total. One,
three out of four.
Four total. There's a Legal Times article, double-sided. There are two cheat sheets and one page for CPD. In terms of the initial interview versus the callback interview. For those of you who have had initial interviews, congratulations. Those who haven't yet, there's still plenty of time, and not during the OCI process, it'll be during many other processes by which law students and lawyers get jobs. So, perspective-wise, if anyone's freaked out that things aren't happening yet for them in fall recruitment, don't come in and talk with us. Let's make an appointment and talk about, you know, what you're doing, if there is anything, maybe some red flags going on, or maybe there are not, there aren't, maybe everything's fine, it's just that dynamics aren't right, the rates aren't exactly where they need to be. Bottom line, lots of different ways to get jobs in lots of different places. But moving forward, the callback, the initial interview process, 20 minutes long usually, a screening interview, it's much more shallow just by virtue of it being just a few minutes, and there are some sort of instant buttons that you hit immediately. Not the least of which is rapport. I mean, it's very much about, you've made it at this stage through most of the numbers, that is, you've been screened or vetted by the firm, usually a firm, of course, we do have public sector employers on campus as well during this time of year. But you've been vetted in terms of the numbers of these, in terms of the dynamics of your resume. You seem to be on all fours in terms of what their hiring policies are as an FDR. And now it's just a matter of, hey, does this person have three heads and can he or she articulate well why he or she wants to be affiliated with our organization? And let's talk about maybe any red flags that might be there. But again, in the context of 20 minutes, you just have so much time to do that. So if you've made it past that point, congratulations, but you still haven't won the game. The next step is obviously the callback interview, and that's what we're going to get to in depth here. And the callback interview is not just a bunch of mini screening interviews put all together in the firm or the organization's place of employee. It, depending on the firm or the organization, it can be very, obviously employer, it can be a very, very long process of a full day or several hours during the day where you're having maybe 45-minute, hour-long conversations with people, you're dining with them perhaps over lunch, you're meeting with crazed associates, maybe a deal just blew up on them and they're supposed to interview but they don't have a whole lot of time, you're meeting with a partner who has lots of time, thank you very much, and she really wants to get to know you. Any and all of these dynamics are fair game. There's no standard across the board by which everyone will experience the same thing. But there are some definite dynamics that will and will not happen. And the best way to sort of go about it is, you want to sort of walk me through this at this point? Or how you
sure. I was thinking of the best way to present this material today, and I was thinking back on all the different speeches that I've done. I think the best analogy I can draw is, this is your first opportunity to really show what type of lawyer you will be. And a lot of people make the mistake of thinking that an interview is just, you know, a way to go talk to people and meet people. And so what I did was I created this template here, which is called Preparing for Your Interview Like a Lawyer. And I drew analogies to how each part of the interview is similar to the way you would approach a case. For example, and what we'll go through today, follow this order of things, is the yellow sheet for everyone looking for that. You really need to show a lot of things about yourself. And how many people here like to sell themselves? How many people are comfortable selling themselves?
How many people here know what it means to sell oneself?
What do you think it means to sell yourself? Yeah, sure.
Put your best foot forward.
Yeah, show your selling point. Why you have to sit first, what you're going to bring, and what, how you. Right. I imagine most people probably didn't raise their hand because it's sort of embarrassing to say that you like selling yourself. No one really does that. But I want to hone in on how important it is, whether you don't have to do it directly like a used car salesman. But Matthew and I will talk about different ways that you need to sell yourself. Because merely showing up to an interview after an initial round interview is not enough to get the job. It's really not. You have to actively proactively show them why you think you would be a good fit for their firm. And this document here goes through ways to do that. Starting with number one, subsection, the facts. When you're drafting a brief, you talk about the facts, and you need to research the facts. Here, you need to research the firm, research your interviewers, and research yourself. And we'll talk about each of those in more detail. Number two is the argument section, is the argument in support of your candidacy. What is it about you that, why they should hire you? And it usually boils down to two element. It's one, you need to be able to show that you have the ability and the brains and the aptitude to be able to handle the work. And the second one is you need to show that you have the enthusiasm and the interest in doing it. It's really that simple, those two parts. And if you can do a good job sending those messages, you've done a lot of the work. And the last one is overall is making the judge like you, is the collegiality and interpersonal skills, which Matt alluded to. Or do you mind if I call you Matt?
No, please.
Why do I always call you Matt? I know you're Matthew.
Matt's fine.
All right.
I've been high school before, Dan. Can I call you Daniel?
Sure.
Don't call me like you suffer. Sorry.
So you've got to make the judge like you, and we'll talk about strategies for that as well and interweaving your questions. But if you really keep this framework in mind, I think you'll have a little bit more of a focus. All right, this is what I really need to do and make sure that I'm following it in somewhat of this logical form. So that's what we're going to talk about today. And if you have any questions, sir, just feel free to raise a hand.
I'm going to echo that, but I'm also going to say the obvious that, okay, great, I've got a couple pieces of paper here, and I see on OCPD's website we have all the cheat sheets, and I sort of get it, guys. I understand what I'm supposed to do, but I don't know if I'm doing it right. And underlying this whole thing is the fact that you need to practice this stuff. Practice. I mean, it's just like when you're you're reading a case or something, you sort of reading, you sort of get it, but until perhaps you're writing it down or talking about it in class or in your study groups, that you happen to force yourself to articulate, so I know what the judge is saying. But when you start talking about it, you realize that, well, perhaps it's not as crystallized as you thought. And there are some folks in here who have the pleasure of engaging in mock interviews, and all of this is to support the fact that great practice is through mock interviewing. Even if you feel like you're on top of your game, it doesn't hurt to set up a mock interview, because invariably, you're presenting some issues, you know all of the facts in your head, but when you're articulating them to me or someone else in a mock interview, you're leaving things out, and me, I don't know you from Adam, and I'm just listening to you in a very objective way. I'm not getting that sort of sub rosa agenda level that you think everyone knows is embedded in your head. So a mock interview is a great way to flush out what you're doing right, but what you're doing wrong. And also, sometimes it's not just about content. I mean, the content drives this whole thing. The content has to be there. You have to know all this information. You have to know the data about the firm. You have to know the data about the interviewer. You have to know the data about yourself, your motivation, the why here, why now, why us, why this city kind of stuff. Sure, you need to know that. That's almost ground level, no brainer. But how are you going to present this information? How are you, what messages are you sending when you're saying it? How verbose or concise are you doing so? What does that say about, boy, if I call this associate in to talk to me about the research today, it took me blah, 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 for half an hour to convey 5 or 10 minutes worth of information. So they're making these kinds of assessments as well. What are their oral skills? What are their advocacy skills? Do you feel confident talking about your candidacy? Are you giving a good argument in terms of why you are well positioned to add value to this organization, which at the end of the day, they're looking to understand? Are you going to bring the kind of value we need to this organization? This organization has a very real business structure. You understand it, even if it's a nonprofit organization, has a mission, has to accomplish something. You understand that. And are you able to speak to that intelligently? And are you able to sell your value vis-a-vis their needs in such a way that you are more compelling than your classmate at WCL or someone across the street at Georgetown or from Harvard or whatever? Because at this point, you're almost sort of fungible. You're all smart folks. You've all made it this far. But the game's not over. Now we have to make these hyper decisions. We're cutting the layers real thin now. So. And individually, what you say might not make a big deal, but cumulatively speaking, it might end up being, all things being equal, you have to make the offer to one person, she gets it first.
The use of one, the choice of one word over lunch can make or break an interview. And I've seen it when I was interviewing people. And I don't want to scare you all into thinking that you have to be hyper paranoid about everything you say, because that's also counterproductive. But I think the only way to get yourself in the zone where you're comfortable and doing your best natural self is by preparing yourself so that you don't have to hyper-analyze everything that you're doing during the interview. How many people have done mock interviews so far at the Career Services Office? Okay.
Not to put you on the spot, but did anyone feel like they didn't walk away with something that really added to their interview process? I mean, maybe you're not comfortable raising your hand, or maybe you are, and that would be something worth exploring. Not to put you on the spot.
Okay. I'll just say this. I regularly talk to career services people in law schools, and the people that do mock interviews statistically always do better on interviews than people that don't do interviews. And I will, and I'm not getting paid to say this from Matt or Tracy, I'll go out on a limb and say if you do not do a mock interview, you are really hurting your chances of getting the best job you can. You're going to be working for the next 50,000, 100,000 years of your life, making millions of dollars in this job and hours a day. You want to get the best position for you. And in order to do that, you really owe it to yourself to do the best job to prepare for this. And I didn't take advantage of mock interviewing when I was in law school. I should have, and I know a lot of people that should have. So you have an opportunity now to really take advantage of it, and if you don't, you're putting yourself at a disadvantage. So take advantage of it, because these people are really good at this type of stuff, and it makes sense. So,
how not to be redundant? Same questions at the same firm. That's a good question. You know, are the people who you're interviewing trading notes afterwards? Are they getting together and say, hey, you know, Sally asked, what did Sally ask you about? This is what she asked me. Or how did she respond to this question? They're probably not as concerned with that as much as they are individual dynamics and whether or not you ask the right questions of the right people. Now, if you're going in there, I wouldn't be overly concerned with questions that come up during the dynamics of interview A within the organization and redundant ones that come up with interview B within the organization, because those people are driving the show and you have to just perform for their little audience. And if they want to ask you why you're interested in working in Albuquerque, even though the last four people asked you the same question, it's a brand new show. You're going to talk to her and as much as you can about why this interests you and you're really good. And then what you want to try to do maybe is how to integrate that into your conversation. Wow, Mr. Smith, you're the fourth person because I've met today and I've really enjoyed all my interviews. And you're actually the fourth person to ask that question. I can see, obviously, that that's an important issue in the organization. I just want to be, again, very emphatic with you that Albuquerque, although it's not my hometown, is where my fiance is, whatever the answer is. So here's a way, perhaps, to take a question that's being asked of you in a redundant style and maybe pick up on it. Are they just being boring interviewers? Because quite frankly, some interviewers are not so great, and they'll ask canned questions. Or is this really an issue for this organization? And if so, have I not made myself clear enough that they have the benefit of seeing you perform in a previous interview? But I need to make sure that I am emphatically clear in my response to these questions, because obviously it's a hot question.
Yeah, I completely agree that it's okay. A lot of my candidates, experienced attorneys, when they're interviewing, they're worried about sounding like broken record, and it's perfectly normal, but you don't sound like a broken record to each person. It sounds completely fresh. And often, what you mentioned before was that they do sometimes go back and compare answers, so you want to make sure that you're being consistent. I agree with everything.
So if they're asking the same question, it is for the purpose of soliciting a consistency, but don't feel everything has to be all the time. And but what you don't want to do is ask the same question. I guess that would be number three, which is, you know, where do great questions come from? So it's one thing for you to be asked the same questions and giving the same responses. It's another thing for you to keep asking everyone the same questions. And that's something I think I would be a bit more reluctant to do. Unless there's, you know, one or two, in case of emergency, great class and ask questions. I can't come up with anything else, or a canned question that I'll always have. That's worst case scenario stuff. So, where do great questions come from? Well, from an interviewer, she might have a sheet that the firm says asking these questions, or she might be a great interviewer, or she just might be going through the machinations. But when it comes from you, the interviewee, those great questions need to come from preparation, and also from the dynamics of the conversation that you're having. Live questions, things that demonstrate active listening. Oh, Bob was actually listening to my response, and he's asking some questions from that. That's the best kind of question you can ask. The question that germinates from the conversation that you're having to make it interactive. Mr. Smith, you mentioned earlier that the merger with this firm in Boston sort of created a couple of glitches, and I'd like to sort of go back to that. You asked me, and I'd like to ask you, how is the firm, what has the firm done to resolve that in terms of integrating the new two associates into that matter? So what you're doing there is showing that you're listening and showing that you're sensitive of their business needs and dynamics and are tapping into that. Do you have a question?
But another thing I'd like to add is about questions to ask. The best questions to ask are, I call it wanters versus contributors. And I think a lot of people, when I was in law school, I was focusing on what I want, what's best for me, this is the type of practice that I want to work with this type of group of people. And then as an interviewer, I was looking for people that were talking about how they could contribute. So to the extent you're focusing on what you want, what you won't do, what you're very limiting, you know, sort of what's in it for your best interest, that's a yellow flag for me as an interviewer, because it shows the mind frame of the interviewee is focused on only what they want to do. What if they only want to do corporate finance work, but we need them to work on some securities litigation? Are they going to, you know, not be excited about that? Are they going to want to leave the firm? So to the extent you can focus on what you can contribute to a firm and what your strengths are and how that will allow you to contribute to the firm, I think that's the best mind frame to adopt in terms of the questions that you're asking. For me, questions that I don't really recommend are things that are focusing on training. What kind of training programs do you have? Because that's about me. How are you going to train me? When the firm's really worrying about how can you help us with all this work. So just that's one thing to keep in mind that I've always sort of had a little bit of a pet peeve with, and I know a lot of other attorneys can't really put their finger on it, but they get turned off when people are focusing too much on what they want in terms of what they can give.
I would also not hesitate to ask open-ended questions, which require them to give some thought, which will allow you to respond to in terms of John, any other questions? And you've had a good report, a good conversation. And I always like to ask, can you tell me what's the sort of the profile of the ideal associate? Who excels in this organization? What are the characteristics there? And I mean, I thought, what Dan said in terms of asking me what works well for this firm, what's interesting to you guys, not what's interesting to me. And then drawing out some information from which then you can respond. Well, you talk about,
actually, we need someone to take initiative, some writers to really, read the stuff once and get it across the table. And for me, it's really important in our litigation practice to have a great professional.
Well, Mr. Jones, I'd like to speak to some of those points because I took the clinic at WCL, I was familiar with one of the National Bank Clinics, and we had the Rule 16 lawyers, we had to represent real clients and cases, and hot fast up and you address in Serrata those three things and integrate how you actually perform to those levels. That's a very effective way of selling yourself, but selling yourself based on what the firm tells information of the firm giving you about what their needs are.
Right. Preventing evidence in support of your argument. These are examples of why I think I'm a good fit. Another great question that I tell a lot of my candidates to ask is, what do you like about practicing at this firm? Because people always like to talk about positive things. And the interview cheat sheet that I gave out goes through a lot of questions to avoid, things to focus on. I think you'll find that to be real gold mine. But focus on why they like it. Don't ask why they don't like it, because that takes things down a negative road. Don't ask negative types of questions during the interview. If you have negative questions that you're sincerely, genuinely interested in, wait till after you have the offer in hand, then go out to lunch with some of the associates, and then you can really grill them on the tough questions. But right now you're in sell mode. You want to get the offer, and then you can decide later on if it's something that you want to accept. Don't confuse this process with an opportunity to get all your questions answered. So keep it positive. Why do you like? What made you come to this firm? I saw from your background that you were at DLA Piper before joining Howell Goldstein 2 years years ago. What do you like about Hal Goldstein? Why did you come here? What is it about this practice that a smaller boutique office as opposed to a larger office that you found attractive? Focusing on them, they love to talk about themselves. And so that's really the best thing you can do to build rapport. And number three, make the judge like you. It's really critical.
Dad said, made a very good point, but I have to offer an exception to it. That is, in terms of, this isn't as much an information gathering opportunity for you as the interviewer. That is, if they get, have all of, like, all of your questions answered, and honestly, you're more in sell mode now. I would say the exception would come up, and it's a guarded exception, where you had an offer that you have not accepted, so you're still in the game. Still shopping other initial interviews and callback interviews. You are comfortable with this offer, however, such that, you know, I think if all else fails, I would really be comfortable working here. So you have a strong reference point against which to shop prospective offers. And in that case, I might be a bit more aggressive and inclined to ask a bit more detailed questions in terms of. And it might even, it depends on the dynamic, I'm not saying absolutely to do this, but I can get your feedback on it. Mr. Jones, I am really concentrating in Albuquerque, and I was just fortunate enough yesterday to get an offer from a mega firm in Albuquerque, and it seems really interesting, it seems like a great firm, but I'm very interested in this firm as well, and I'm hoping you can sort of help me understand what you see to be the differences in these two firms. Specifically, I have questions about this and that.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great point, and thanks for bringing that up. Another thing is, if you do have one other offer from another firm, it's okay to tell the next firm, I have an offer from this firm, and I'm sort of considering that. That will put the firm into high gear sell mode to you, because when they know that the competitor is giving you an offer, their competitive spirit comes out, and they want to try to make sure that they don't lose a good candidate to somebody else. So I think it's a good way to even if drop it in, let the recruiting manager know that you've got an offer somewhere else, or just sort of don't feel like you have to be very secretive about that, because it can actually work to your advantage if you're interviewing with competitors. Always try, especially with the partner. And a question you asked about, or someone asked about the difference between associate and partner interviews, that's also a great question. I always give people a lot of, I think there's some advice in that interview cheat sheet. It says, bond with the associate and focus on making the partners realize that you can help their make their life easier. I think with the junior associates, they just want someone that they can play with. They want a friend in the office. If they're at office at 11 at night or going on a train to New York for a big case, they want someone that they can be friends with and hang out with that's not going to be annoying to them. So with the junior people, they may sometimes come across as being more hard in their questions. It's just they're trying to act like they're big shots. So don't get intimidated by the fact that the junior attorneys may be asking you real tough questions. But really, I think bonding with them, why did you know, what firms were you choosing between when you were in law school? What made you choose this firm? What do you like about working here? How are the people to work with? Those are all very good questions for junior associates, because you're bonding with them like a friend. When you get to the partner, it's more sell mode. This is how, the skills that I've gotten, this is why I think I'd be a great attorney. And you also need to sell with the junior associates, but I think more so with the partners, it's explaining why you have the characteristics to be a really solid attorney. And with the associates, it's explaining that, but with an eye towards bonding with them a little bit more. Definitely ask the same question. Vary them up the whole.
questions. And you might even want to integrate some of the information you've already collected. That is to say, Mr. Partner, and I've been, everyone's been wonderful and very forthcoming with information, the questions I've asked. One of which dealt with, because your website talks about your unique management style, a few of the management styles here in the firm. And from the associate's perspective, at least, those who my so far interviewed, they seem to be very pleased with the integration of the unique management style, etc. From the partner standpoint, from your standpoint, how do you see that being implemented? And so, see, you're not just answering the same question, you're setting it up in such a way that shows thoughtfulness as to why you're asking it. It shows consideration of the fact that you're a good lawyer, you do your research, and you don't just ask the same bloody question to three different people. And you're building on a knowledge set, and you might therefore solicit a more focused response as opposed to just generally, can you tell me about the management style? You might give you the book of mind that she gave you, that she gave you, that he gave you.
And the best interviews, I'll get to that in 1 second. Or lunch, I'll start with your question.
It's sort of related. I was wondering, based on what you just said about sometimes it's actually effective to bring up to the receiving offer, and I was wondering whether the same is true for other callback interviews, particularly if they're on the same day, so maybe the prospective employer knows that you went to someplace else.
Yeah, I think it's good. The only footnote is if you're interviewing in two cities, and you have a callback in Tampa Bay, but you're with a New York firm, you know, family, you're going to get an offer from Holland and Knight's Tampa office, because that shows them that you're, you know, not necessarily committed to their city. The other thing about, that's a whole other can of worms, which we have like 5 hours to talk about this. I'm trying to race with all my best thoughts here. The other thing about interviews, the best interviews are not interrogations or depositions or questions asked or question answer. The best ones are if you've been talking and you don't even realize that you've been asked 5 questions, but they just come up naturally in the flow of conversation. Such as, oh, really? How did that happen? Or why that? Or explain that. Not, well, all right, here, I've got a couple of questions. Tell me about your firm's training program. Well, we did, you know, it's just so administrative and monotonous. Sprinkle in little questions during the conversation. And one great way to do that is by researching firms. And I think we should talk a little bit about researching, how critical it is to research firms, not just what's on the website, but going beyond what's on the website. Know the bios of the people you'll be meeting with. Know the recent news and events that have happened in the law firm. But also do a search on Lexis and the Legal Times over the past 3 years for the firm's name to see if any stories have come up, any groups have joined the firm, any groups have left the firm. If you're interviewing with litigators and you happen to have some extra time, the best thing you can do is do a Lexis search for which cases on which their attorney of record, read some of those cases, and point out to them during the interview that you researched not only them, but you read some of the decisions that they were the attorney of record on. I guarantee you, do an experiment, trust me on this, I would be hard-pressed to not get a lot of interest from a firm that is litigation-focused if you were to take that step. Because it shows so many things about your skill as an attorney. If I give this person who researched me to the hill, knows about cases I've worked on, they're going to do a really thorough job on an assignment I have to do. They're not going to just stop at step one. They're going to go to step two, three, four. This person's really passionate about this work, and they're great researchers. And as an attorney, one of the key characteristics that you have is your research skills. So this is your opportunity to show really what a good researcher you are and how you can help them by being a good researcher. So do not miss this opportunity to research them in their practice. When I'm interviewing people to be recruiters with our company, if they haven't read my bio, if they haven't read articles I've written, I'm immediately not interested in them because it shows that they're not good researchers, which is a critical component. Yes?
I would say that a stupid question is like, so I noticed in the first union that you made summary judgment motion, and I thought it was kind of interesting. Can you talk about that? I mean, does that kind of come off that?
Well, you could.
What is the rule?
Yeah.
came out of nowhere.
Yeah, yeah. What, I mean, just to come out of nowhere, they'll think you're a total fool. Well, I mean, no, actually, probably there are certain lot of fools out there that would think that's great. So I take that back. But I think, you know, if you work it in, you can say something like, you know, I was researching your background and I noticed that, you know, you've done a lot of cases, you know, for work on this issue, and I read so-and-so of these decisions. You know, have you worked on a lot of these cases? Talking about their practice, you don't want to start going right into legal arguments and debating points like you would with a professor. So just bring it in there, you know, slowly like that. One quick question about the importance of research. Who, by any chance, I know you didn't have to research me because I'm the speaker here, but who happens to know something about my background that I didn't mention today? Anything. You can guess something that maybe you're not. First person to guess something that may be relevant. What's that?
Alright. Good point.
How did you determine that?
Coloring for the red.
Give this man an iPod.
Only one of those moments, and if you let it go by, it just goes by. I mean, you have to seize the moment.
My point is, researching has its rewards, and the reason I sort of did that was to emphasize how important it is to research and to know the people that you're talking to. Even if it's not, you know, it always is a great skill as an attorney to research the people that you'll be meeting with and talking to. So do not overlook that. If you're choosing between spending an extra 15 minutes briefing a case or researching your interviewers a little bit more, without offending any of the professors, I would strongly suggest for this point spend a little more time researching the people and the practices.
And even there, just to underscore the iPod example, obviously no one did the research here, so you shouldn't have done it. But what you did do is pick up on something that wasn't discoverable on paper or in LexisNexis, and that is being cognizant of your environment. I had a very soul wedding in there, perhaps that was a subject matter from which to discuss. I had a very strong interview, very big firm, where I was borderline on the grade. And I was in there, I'm sure I was probably going to be like a last cut. But I saw pictures on the wall of this man's daughter by the pyramid in Egypt, and I had just come back from backpacking in the Middle East. And the interview was going okay. And I immediately sort of brought that up, and we spent the next 45 minutes discussing his daughter, a trip to Egypt and Israel, and my backpacking travels through there, etc. I got a call that evening with the office. And that's not to say, that is to say that I think I had a direct connection to it. Because did I research that? No. This was something that I was aware of my environment, aware of human dynamics, aware of people's hot buttons, aware of things that might be interesting to people. Not being Machiavellian about it, that's what can I do here? But let's look around. I mean, there are a lot of golf trophies. There are a lot of pictures of me, you know, bass fishing. That stuff talks about you as an individual, not as this automaton law student answering the questions that you want answered. Don't sell that stuff short.
Yeah,
that's really important.
Oftentimes, people you'll find some people on an interview that don't want to talk about anything law related. They'll just say, "So, just tell me, what do you like doing in your free time?" Because they want to know that you're not a tool. And that you're someone that they're going to be spending hours and hours and hours with you over the next 1 to 3 to 5 to 7 to 10 years. They want to know that you're someone that they can get along with. And oftentimes, I have a friend that's still in a big firm, and she'll interview some of my candidates, and I'll call her up right afterwards and say, "What did you think? What did you think?" She'll say, "Well, the test that she always uses. Would I get annoyed if they were to knock on my door at 9:30 at night with a question?" And that was her whole barometer. Is this the type of person that just would annoy me, or is it someone that I would like? And so it's incredibly important to establish a rapport with people.
Just to segue from what you were on the cutoff with your grade.
Right.
There's been a lot, I guess a lot of talk of, you know, how much does the callback now be accepted to who you are on paper and now the personality. Does the who you are on paper, I assume, still matter? To what degree does it matter after this callback process?
Right. And I think that also ties in with percentage. Yeah. I'll let you talk about the percentage part, but I'll sort of lead it off with the fact that, again, we talk in generality, but you never know the dynamics of individuals, let alone the organization. So in this case, it was a very personal self like this individual decision maker, owner, partner, who basically called the shot. And this was the kind of decision you made at the moment. Well, this is my opportunity. I'm either going to play this hand or not. And sometimes you win, sometimes you don't. And that's sort of a judgment call you have to make. But suffice it to say, for the most part, look, they are interested in the person that they see on paper. For the most part, at least you made the grid. You know, you got the right GPA, you got the right law school. Okay, you're in. You can do the work. You're mentally capable of doing the work. Check that box. Now we're here to see, because on paper it looks like he might fit within this organization. He worked for this place, he worked for that place, he had these kinds of hobbies. That seems pretty like an interesting candidate. But of course, that's just paper. So now we need to flush out whether or not you really do fit, whether or not this does is a fair representation of you, the person. And I can only get that through that kind of interdynamics. I mean, you can read a personal ad. You don't love me, tell her, say, oh, wow, right, this is exactly what I'm attracted to. Then you meet a person, that there's no chemistry, there's no dynamic, nice person, et cetera, but it's just not clicking. So there's a little bit of that going on. As much as, you know, will you do the work? What is your work ethic like? And I can tell a lot by your aloofness, by your body language, by how cocky and certain you are that you can do just fine, thank you very much, as the editor-in-chief of the law review. And believe me, people come across this way, and people don't get offers because of this. Because they are smart, because they otherwise seem like decent people, but their work ethic is coming through, not because you discuss work ethic, but because your mannerisms or the way you respond to certain questions show that, you know what, getting out of here in a reasonable time is a little bit more important to me than getting the job done. Not that you would ever say that, but we were telling us the other day that over lunch with one of the interviewers, they said, I think they were from a federal agency downtown, overlooking the mall, and one person that they were very interested in ended up the interview saying, well, one of the reasons I'm really interested in working with you is because I'm on a Frisbee team, and I know they play down at the mall, and they start at 5:30, and I know if I work there, it's fun to get it. This was real, and they were like, great, I mean, definitely not getting made bail, I was really easy, but definitely not getting an offer. A person they were otherwise sort of interested in. That's an extreme, but real anecdote.
Yeah.
So be careful about what you say or what you believe.
Right, there are a lot of ways that sort of at this point, firms are trying to weed down the list of all these people that they've got callbacks with. To answer your question, in the Washington, D.C. market generally, the most recent statistics show that about 60% of the people that go on callbacks get offers, and of those people, usually one out of four and five people accept. So the question, I think that's taking into account all the schools in D.C. There's Georgetown and GW, which has a bigger pool, I think, of students. So I would think that probably I would assume maybe one-third chance of getting a call back. That's how it was when I was in law school, and I would think probably around that level of AU right now it's about a one-third chance. But the thing is, a lot of firms really like AU because, it's got a great reputation, but I've heard firms say, I'd rather have someone in the top of their class at AU than in the middle of their class from Harvard, because they're going to work much harder, they're going to be not as spoiled as some of the Ivy Leagues. And my wife, when she was at a big firm in New York right after law school, she went to AU as well. She got a job that's fantastic, one of the biggest firms in the world, and they said how much they like AU students because they've got a strong work ethic, and they're not necessarily coddled into thinking that, oh, I'm going to have all these offers coming to me. So I think to the extent you can reinforce that message by showing that you're really hard worker and a gunner, that's the best thing you can do.
I'm just trying to make sure you can address these questions.
What's up with lunch, sort of integrated with what you said earlier about questions that are sort of part of the dynamics, but let's just talk about it a little bit more. Has anyone here had an uncomfortable lunch scenario or particularly rate of a lunch scenario that wants to share? Or, okay,
great. It took me this issue. And I assume all you can tell.
Okay.
I'm pretty great with that. And they both ordered weird stuff. And then I don't want to look at what or weird stuff. I don't want to order more for your food. So I ordered some shrimp sushi, and about 5 minutes after I ordered it, I swallowed it, sucked it down, feeling great. And then fried shrimp head came out. And I was like, this is that. It's just like, of yours. And I was like, oh, it's great. So I ate it, but, it was kind of interesting.
Did he ask you up front whether or not you have any kind of preferences in terms of your food?
And I said, you like sushi? Well, I do like sushi, but, I wasn't great with the chocolate.
Okay. Some points to discuss there. Some more.
Make jokes with me and
you know, I thought, wow, this person's really cool, because they were treating me like I was a friend, and because of that, I felt more comfortable with them as well. So let your personality come through. Smile, laugh, ask questions, be human, because most of the other law students out there that are interviewing are coming in like nervous robots. And you will have an advantage if you can really get along with them better. And the more you laugh, the more you have a good time, the more they're going to like you. And the more they like you, the more they're going to overlook your weaknesses and play up your strengths. And the less they like you, the more they're going to play up your weaknesses and play down your strengths. Very subjective, but it's human nature. It happens all the time.
Another question, but I just want also comment in terms of, now what happens if you're offered a choice at lunch? You like sushi, you're going out for sushi. I don't mind sushi, but actually if there's a choice, what are some other options? I mean, it's not like a choice, it's difficult. If they're offering you, this is then take advantage of it within the reason. If you don't like sushi, or if you have an aversion, you know, if you have a food allergy, obviously, if you really just would not, it's not that you don't really have to move for it, but if you know you just can't stomach it. I mean, this is not a science, folks. This is human dynamics. It depends on what the dynamics are. If they're jovial, good, loud. They offer a bunch of things. They're in Manhattan. There's 3,000 restaurants right downstairs. But okay, so suppose you even sort of prefer, like, okay, yeah, sushi's okay. And then you say, oh, yeah, sure, I love sushi. Well, then you bought into it. Then you got to be a good player. And then you order something there that is, don't try to impress. I mean, you know California rolls. You know they're innocuous. You know you can tolerate them. And you maybe have some fun and apologize, but you know what, I'm really not with the chopsticks. I love to go to sushi. I hope you don't get embarrassed by using fork. Or
something like that. Again, it's human nature. It's not going to
be. But it can be more awkward if you order something that you don't know what it is, and it ends up being a fried shrimp head, and it's like, now you're freaking out, but it's pretty nasty. And that creates a worse dynamic than honesty. So the honesty is the best policy.
Yeah, another thought I was going to have along the honesty is the best policy is, humanizing yourself is also a really good thing to do on interview, because everyone knows what you've been through, and as experienced attorneys, there's a side of them that sort of looks at you and says, no, I sort of feel bad for them because I know how tough it is because I went through it. One thing you could have done in that situation is, what I probably would have done, but it's my sense of humor, is I would have come out and said, I got to be honest, I didn't want to say no, and when you got the sushi, I was felt like I had to say yes, I hate sushi. And they may have I could usually get away with it, but, you know, it depends on your personality, but they may actually start laughing and be like, that's so funny, I did that on an interview too. And it can sort of build up, you know, a type of rapport. It's risky, but sometimes you can, if the timing's right and you've got that type of sense of humor, you can get away with things like that and go a long way.
First of all, it's probably the most expensive entree, faux pas number one, search and turn.
But he also didn't know how to eat a lobster, so it was cold. And he remembered that one of the interviews now was from New England, and he said, oh, so you're from, I remember you said you're from New England, do you think you could show me how to eat this? And it actually went, it worked out really well because it was just a lot of labor.
That's fun.
So but my question was, when you're scheduling a callback, is it your detriment? Is that going to hurt your chances, or is it better to always get the morning so that you have lunch?
Good question. I personally, I just think the difference between morning and afternoon has to do a lot with sometimes people's, I'm more awake in the morning, and I might be more alert. I'm not sort of tired from having done a whole first round and watching someone getting in the afternoon. But then again, lots of law firms, they didn't start later. You know, people show up at 10, 10, 11 o'clock. The day doesn't start kicking in until 3, 4 in the afternoon. So I would say there is a right line. Better that lunch, not that lunch, better than morning and afternoon. Other than those sort of dynamics, the more time you spend with people, the more time you have to build rapport. P.S., the more time you have to screw up, too. So if you're worried about that, that's the way it is.
You know, I used to psychoanalyze it, and
better mood or were they more mad because of the afternoon or, you know,
it makes no difference. I mean, whatever is easiest for the firm, defer to their schedule. So whatever is easiest for you, that's how it goes. I'll leave the menu, thanks.
Yeah, I would definitely defer to, again, do whatever else is ordering. The worst thing they could do is ask me to order first, and if so, just go mid-range. Just go mid-range. You know, don't order the least expensive. Much more expensive. Definitely don't order the most expensive thing.
Yeah.
This is an opportunity to enjoy lunch. It's an opportunity to get a good lunch. What firm? Sort of threw me off. What was your first question? Oh,
you see the effect it can have? It screws everything up.
You know, they're usually, you know, players at this level are usually smart enough not to want to get down that. They don't want to go there. They're fine enough to go there. If they do, it's probably by accident. But, you know, that's not to say that some people aren't nefarious and will ask that question. I suspect that I would avoid the confrontation at that moment. I would definitely alert the Office of Career and Professional Development. Jenkins are directly there to it immediately because that's something that actions have to be taken. But, you know, we would work with you and respect your wishes as well in preserving your anonymity. And you might find that some sort of like maybe people from other generations are a little more, you know, rough around the edges in that term. Like, oh, yeah, get married anytime. I mean, you cringe if you were the HR person there, but, you know, Frank doesn't mean it. You know, that's the sort of way with people. And that's the kind of orders you have to navigate at the moment. There is a flashpoint issue for you. If you have a response for credit, you can talk about that. Or maybe some diversionary tactics. Well, you know, give me an example. Maybe sort of play it out, or no, and like sort of a.
Well, I think
it's
sort of
an
approach as well.
Right. Well, if they're asking me point blank, they're asking me if I have children, again, I think I would hold off saying that that's an illegal kind of question.
Yeah. I've had a situation where someone literally bombed an interview because they got defensive when that question was asked. It was an older partner that was not very, like Matt said, not very skilled in what you can and can't ask. He said something, you know, about, you know, are you planning on having any other kids? And it was small talk, but this candidate got very defensive, said, I don't think you're allowed to ask that question. And technically, yes, you shouldn't have asked that question, but what you did was you really sort of left a bad taste in the managing partner's or whatever partner's mouth. So I would probably just go along with it, and unless there's a specific reason why you don't want to disclose this information, I think trying to avoid it or not answering the question will inevitably cause more damage than just answering the question. Because oftentimes, you know, those types of issues aren't going to make much difference at all, even on a subjective, subconscious level anyway.
And you could even, at that level, also say, work with that issue. And yes, actually, the point blank, you have to yes, and you have children actually, and there are several of them. Give them the background. If they're asking that question, what's the real question they're asking? Are you going to be able to stay late? Can you do the work, etc.? So you might want to disabuse them of any of those preconceived notions that they might have just because you're a parent about this. And then, yeah, actually, I do have children, and we have a great support at home. So to the extent that, you know, I know I'm engaged, you know, sitting on a very aggressive career here. Know the hours of the day, so that's not going to be a problem for me. If that's an all or concern of yours, I just want to put my needs, that's already been figured out, care of, too much of a long time, whatever. So you sort of address the bigger, oh no, I didn't mean any of that. You know, we support children here, we love our family, friendly, oh, that's great to hear too. But just in case, so you know it's not an issue.
Exactly, yeah, great. Great. In that situation, that's a great question because it often the trick is you're not given softball questions to really sell yourself. Sometimes they'll say, "Tell me about your strengths," and then you can come right out and plan it. But usually, you need to work it in to the question. And what I so what was the question that you had? I'll try to come up. Some people say so. Then they're obviously starting at a different point. So, you know, so tell me, you know, I'm interested in these practice areas. Be able to, oh, just footnote. I'll get to this afterwards. Explain
why you're interested in a practice area. And I'll talk a little bit more on this, but that's critical. Remind me to talk about why you're interested in a particular practice area. So I'm interested in this type of work. I've heard great things about your firm. Obviously, I was excited to interview here. So I'm interested in learning about your experience and what you all are looking for in potential new hires. And then when he starts talking about what they're looking for, people that are smart, that have good writing skills. You know, you mentioned that writing is very important here. You know, I've been involved in journal and, you know, wrote on to Law Review. And these, you know, I've actually really enjoyed writing. Is that something that I'd be able to do a lot of in this practice? So find out what they're looking for, what types of people do well, and then sell yourself by sort of shoehorning yourself into the holes that they create for you to fill. And you can't come straight out. You know, it's often, it's not clear cut. You need to wiggle it in different points. That's a good question.
Okay. I just want to sit this way somewhere a bit, because that's where one firm that we usually don't tell you who you're going to interview with for a callback, and another one says we're not going to tell you until a few hours, like the night before. So do you have any specific tips, especially if this one is on Friday, actually, if they don't tell you who you're going to be at all, is there any specific way to prepare for that?
Are you interviewing with a large practice group at the firm, or is it a small practice group, or do you not know?
It's a large branch office.
The firm that you're thinking of, probably one or two. Talk to me afterwards, and I can give you advice on the firm and what seems to be their hot practice areas. Also, one other thing I want to put out there is if anyone has any questions about anything, feel absolutely free to call me. If you're interviewing at firms and you want to know the inside scoop, what's going on, where their hiring needs are, feel free to call me. My information is on the interview cheat sheet. You can call me. Calling is better because I get a lot of emails and sometimes can't write my full responses, so I just prefer a call. But feel free to call me anytime if you have any questions about anything at all. It's totally cool. And if it's during an evening, you can call on my cell phone as long as it's not before 10 o'clock at night. If you have a question for an interview the next day, my cell phone number is 301-801-6569. So feel free to take me up on that offer. Sure. Other questions?
Other questions? Yeah, we have it on our document library, as I mentioned earlier. You can always get it from eCampus through this document library. This one we'll put up later. This is preparing for you to be like a lawyer. That's what you want.
Okay. One of the biggest mistakes that people make is not clearly articulating why they're interested in an area. I was talking to a law student from another school, fantastic credentials, really had the pedigree to be able to get an offer pretty much any firm. I said, well, let's go through a quick mock interview. So why are you interested in litigation? And this person said, well, I found that, you know, litigation for me is much more, I like helping people come to results and help mediating problems and coming up with solutions to problems rather than fighting. And I was thinking, oh my God, good thing you called me, because if you said that on any of these firm interviews, you will be toast. So if you're interested in litigation, the strongest reasons why you like litigation, and I don't want to tell you to try to beat someone you're not, I know you're writing this down, you can probably parrot it back at your interviews, but I'll just share it for whatever it's worth.
Being podcast.
Right. Podcast with one deleted part. You'll have to bleep out that part. And don't, if anyone tells anyone, you're all in big trouble. I'm going to remember you. Don't say that guy said a four-letter word. The part of litigation, if you're interested in litigation, it's because, first of all, you like writing. Well, people that are good litigators, they're good writers, they're good advocates, they love to win and they hate to lose, and they don't mind fighting with people, but they're also collegial to work with. They are people that have experience with mock trial, debate in high school, that this is in their blood. They like to be right. They hate to be wrong. Those are the characteristics of good litigators. On the corporate side, it's more people that are interested in financial transactions, handling a lot of parts of a big deal. And the other thing is, if you're interested in litigation at large firms, don't talk about trial work, standing up in court. I love arguing and I want to be in court, because the reality is, in this DC market, if you're litigating in a big firm, you're doing case management, which means document review, document production, helping with research, drafting memos. It's unlikely that you're going to be seeing the inside of a courtroom much for the first year, several years of practice, or several years thereafter. It's just not that likely because of the scope of these cases. If you're going to a smaller or mid-sized litigation boutique, where you're doing maybe criminal defense or insurance defense type of work, then you'll be in court. But a lot of people make that mistake when they're talking about litigation positions, that they want to do it because they love arguing in court. Don't fall into that trap. If you have the skills to be a good advocate, a strong writer, a good researcher, those are the things that are necessary, not standing up in court.
That gentleman had a question.
First of all, I have the same issue with not being told to get more reviews and all that.
Okay. What I would just do is research a lot of the bios of the people on the website and just become familiar with the practice.
The problem is, they told me to the practice areas that we deal with, but they said that the other practice areas, some lawyers,
Yeah, that's unfortunate. You can't really do anything in that situation. You know, there's nothing you can do. One other thing, be careful. This is a trap that two traps that I fell into when I was in law school. I was interested in trademark and copyright law, and I was interviewing with a partner from Brian Cave that did construction law, and I felt that because he did construction law and he was interviewing me, I need to be interested in construction law. So I was trying to sell it to why I thought construction law was really great. And then he eventually said, you don't have to say you're interested in construction law. Your whole background is trademark and copyright. I'm not interviewing you for the construction practice. I'm just interviewing you for the firm. And I said, oh, okay, now I can be honest. Yes, never wanted to do construction law. So keep in mind, don't try to sell yourself necessarily based on the interviewer's background. And another thing is, if a firm has practice in one city and not another city, don't say that you're interested, I think the example on the sheet is, the labor and employment practice in one city while they don't have that practice in DC. Some people will interview with a firm in DC and say, I'm interested in labor and employment, when they have labor and employment all over the website, except they don't have anyone in the DC office. So be careful that you're not falling into that trap. Realize that law firms, their websites like to make it look like everybody does everything. They like, because if you look at a person's biography, if you do a quick search, you'll say that they've got 18 people in their corporate finance practice. But if you click on a partner's bio, it will say that they're in 7 different practice areas. So be careful not to fall into that trap, thinking that a firm has a lot more attorneys in a particular practice area than they really do. You need to unpeel the onion a little bit to see how many people are only focusing on that one practice area, and that is a much better gauge of where the firm's hiring needs are. The firm's got tons of attorneys in a particular practice area. Odds are that's where they're looking to hire. Their bread and butter practices are where they usually need people. If you're interviewing with Howery and Simon, odds are they want you to do antitrust and litigation. While they may have a smaller area doing something else, to go in and hedge your bets on the smaller area is really hurting your chances. So just keep that in mind as well.
Another question. Kind of goes off of that. Is it bad to focus yourself too much?
but if you're really interested in one particular bacteria, this bad, and that's something you might know a lot about, and they maybe even have that practice, but it's bad to go and be like, I'd really like this.
You don't want to be.
You want to
show an interest, but you also want to show flexibility and openness, because even if they do have a need in this area right now, what happens in 1 year from now if they lose their biggest client? So you want to send the message that this is something that I've obviously been interested in. I've got a strong background in this area. I'd be happy to do some of this work, but I'm also open on broadening my horizons and working on other areas that where I could use the same skill set that I've gained and apply to other types of litigation or other types of regulatory matters. What is the area that you're thinking? Right. So, you know, I've got a strong telecom background. However, a lot of these are regulatory issues. So, you know, regulatory issues in general, things that I find interesting. So I'm open to other areas as well. And so if you can focus on the regulatory stuff, that's primo in Washington, D.C. Don't limit yourself too much unless it's a boutique firm that only focuses on that type of work.
Don't feel like you have to apologize to these juries either. We began it, perhaps, you know, all the IT stuff, I really want construction law. And certainly discuss it and put it in context and spin on it and then in terms of transferable skills and sort of bigger picture. It's very fungible, as well as having particular expertise in telecommunications. And other questions? What about other questions?
If you have an interview like New York, and they're going to fly you in, and they're paying for that, and it comes out to be very expensive somehow, even though it doesn't cost much in two cities, and they say you can expense the cab ride to the airport, but kind of worried that it's a lot of money, and I don't really feel like I should be adding more costs when there are any costs that have come in. Should I just forget that, so I cut that myself, or is it okay to have that fixed at all?
The thing is, the people that are making the decisions are going to have no idea what you would spend. The expenses are going, usually, unless it's going to the recruiting person, it's usually given directly to one of those assistants that's handling all administrative issues, and they've got a budget for this, and they can absorb the extra $75 much better than you as a law student can. Don't feel bad. They're going to make plenty of money off of you in the future. So it's a nice gesture, but it's a non-issue. Get reimbursed.
Before we answer your question, thank you, Doug. You want to ask one answer? That one, if that came up in the beginning.
Thank you notes are, there's some people, there's really split. Our company's website has a whole article with sort of, it's like an online debate where people are talking about the pros and the cons. I sort of fall on the side of the thank you note is good. Take the time to send it to everybody. Email is fine. Do it quickly. But it's not going to get you the offer, but it could help, it could lose the offer for you. I'll never forget one thank you note that I wrote. I called a Mrs. a Mr. because I was just so rushing to get it out, and still some, you know, I know the person still makes fun of me about it. But whatever you do, have it proofread, double check, and if you're feeling rushed, overwhelmed, and you don't think you can do them well, just don't bother. Don't bother with these. But if you're going to do it, make it slightly different to everybody. Don't write the same thing to everybody. My pet peeve with thank you notes is when people say, I think I'd be a perfect fit. I think it's a little presumptuous. You can say, I'm very enthusiastic or interested in this opportunity. And you can they come to you guys for, I keep coming back to this, but go to Matt or Tracy or any of the other counselors for second opinions, because what seems really perfectly normal to you, oftentimes the second pair of eyes will show that you're falling into a booby trap, and oftentimes you don't realize it until it's too late, and you owe yourself second opinions on these critical things. So I would definitely you know, as quickly as you can, try to get a second opinion, even if it's from a friend.
How do you go about asking it? Can you just regularly call and say, oh, I'm just wondering how the cab has spoken over on the cab?
I think now, under the NAF guidelines, they pay for all reimbursements associated with travel. So anything that you incur, you know, reasonable, I usually don't suggest for meals. It seems like meal may be a little bit, for me, but I mean, anything that's incurred in connection with the travel, if you're traveling for a long time, you have a meal, give it in.
Any reasonable expense. And if you want in advance, it's always nice to have a courtesy call, asking them, well, the cameras are drawn up, and I understand that you'll send me the ticket, but I just wanted to make sure, in terms of the cab, should I pay that out of pocket and submit that expense, or what is the preferred method of transportation from the airport to the firm? And they're not going to say, oh, I'll hop the subway. They're going to say, oh, just get a cab, the other receipt will reimburse you. Because this stuff is
Yeah, do just a quick email. You know, I don't know if that warrants a phone call because they get so many calls a day. They're recruiting people. So for the more admin tasks, just quick email is fine.
Well, we hope that's answered all of your questions. And thanks for sticking out with us here for an hour and a half this year. But I hope it was good for you.
Good luck, and please feel free to take me up on my offer if you have any questions. I'm happy to try to help you.
You won't get an iPod out of it.
You never know.